What's up, everybody? You're listening to The Raven's Grove. I'm your host, Dahi, and today we're going to be going back to our long-running segment, Warfare Through History. More specifically, though, we're going to be diving once more into Viking-era warfare, and we're going to be talking about the Great Heathen Army. Now, before we begin, a few disclaimers. This episode of The Raven's Grove features the following trigger warnings. Blood and gore mentions, death mentions, battle and war mentions, spear mentions, sword mentions, axe mentions, dismemberment mentions, wound mentions, execution mentions, snake mentions, and torture mentions, as well as featuring major spoilers for seasons 4 and 5 of the TV show Vikings. So if any of those are in any way an issue for you, please give this episode a miss. Right, so to start things off, I would like to address some common misconceptions about the Vikings. If you've already listened to the first Warfare Through History episode or the most recent episode on the Battle of Stamford Bridge, this is going to be very repetitious. It's basically I copied and pasted the same things in the scripts. But bear with me, as given the subject of today's episode, I feel it's very important to reinforce these points. It's also not just for the people who are regular listeners, it's also for the people who may be listening to this episode without listening to the previous entries. If you are listening to this before listening to the previous entries, then welcome, I hope you enjoy it. First, the most obvious misconception. Vikings did not have horns on their helmets. Metal helmets were very rare and very expensive in the Viking era, and as such, most Vikings went into battle with either without any head protection or with a simple cap made of fur and or leather. In fact, we've only found one intact Viking helmet in all of archaeology, and it does not have horns. In addition, if you had horns on your helmet in battle, an enemy warrior could easily grab the horns and either throw you off balance or rip the helmet off your head. Which either one of them would be enough of an opportunity for them to kill you. Now, I will admit, there is a distinct possibility that some example of horned headgear may have existed in the Viking era, but let me be extremely clear on this. If it did exist, and that's a very big if, then it would have been solely for religious usage in some like rituals and ceremonies. It would never have been used in battle. So the second myth I'd like to clear up is that the Vikings were all giants in stature. Now, let's take a look at the statistics for the modern average height of an adult man of European descent, shall we? The average height for an adult man in Denmark is 180.4 centimeters, which is roughly 5'11". In Sweden, the average is 181.5, which is centimeters, which is roughly 5'11 and a half. In Norway, it's 179.7 centimeters, 5'11". In Iceland, it's 181 centimeters, 5'11 and a half. Now, by comparison, the average height of an adult man in Australia is 175.6 centimeters, which is 5'9". And the average height of an adult white man in the US is 178 centimeters, 5'10". Now, you might be thinking, well, this is all very interesting, but what does this have to do with the Vikings? Well, according to www.skjalden.com, that's skjalden.com, Viking archaeological excavations on Viking era graves in Scandinavia revealed that the average height for an adult man in the Viking era was approximately 172 centimeters, which is 5'6". This clearly negates the idea that the Vikings were huge mountains of muscle. Third is a stereotype that the Vikings dressed like Conan the Barbarian, by which I mean that they wore very little armor on either a battle kilt or a loincloth and were filthy. Now, I'll admit, I'm a big fan of fantasy fiction. I love stuff like Conan the Barbarian. I've read the books. I love D&D, that kind of thing. But this is not what the Vikings actually look like. Firstly, the Norsemen were phenomenal traders and artists in everything relating to textiles. Viking clothes were often made of linen or wool, and they were often very brightly dyed, usually red, blue, or yellow, or a combination of those three colors. And as to the whole Vikings being filthy thing, when it comes to matters concerning personal grooming and appearance, you'd be hard-pressed to find a culture in Europe up until the middle of the 20th century that was so fastidious about being clean and looking their best. Like, seriously, you look at the primary source materials from the Saxons, they actually were saying that we can't, and I'm paraphrasing here, but this is a very accurate quote, that when the Vikings settled in England, the Saxon church actually sent out a memo saying, we can't let our wives and daughters marry Vikings because they'll seduce them with their shiny swords, their clean hair, and their good breath. That is not just me making that up. Seriously, you look up the primary source documents for yourself, they'll say stuff that's very, very similar to that. Maybe not in those exact words, but it's the exact sentiment behind it. It is quite honestly hilarious for me. Now, the final misconception I'd like to clear up is that the Vikings used either a two-handed sword or a double-haired battle axe. Now, as I have already said in this podcast, I am a massive fan of fantasy fiction, and I really appreciate the barbarian trope in fantasy fiction. Like, Conan the Barbarian is one of my favorite fictional characters from the books. But quite frankly, this isn't fantasy. This is real life. And the sheer fact of the matter is that the most common weapon on the battlefield for a Viking was either a spear or an axe, not a sword. That's not to say swords didn't exist. Swords just were extremely expensive in the Viking era, due primarily to the level of expertise and also the lengthy amount of time and resources needed to properly manufacture one to a high standard. To put this in perspective, having a spear would be the equivalent of having a simple fixed gear bicycle today. It's not the flashiest and most luxurious method of getting around, but it'll get you from point A to point B and back again. Having an axe would be the equivalent of having a car. Like, nothing really fancy, but definite upgrade from a spear. Having a sword, that would be the equivalent of having a top-of-the-line, exorbitantly expensive supercar. Everyone's going to notice you on the battlefield, but at the same time, you get a better performance out of it when it really comes down to the wire. The point is, swords are extremely rare in Viking-era graves. They're just phenomenally rare, especially certain types of swords. For reference, an Ulfbert sword, which is made in Francia, which is modern-day France, Germany, and the Netherlands, they are considered to be some of the best swords ever made. And yes, I'm including katanas in that list. An Ulfbert, in my opinion, can rival a good quality katana. However, they are unbelievably rare to find. As of this recording, I think there's only like 200 swords that have been confirmed to be Ulfberts that have ever been found. There's tons and tons of replicas that are like knockoffs from the Viking era, but Ulfberts are insanely high quality, so you can usually tell the difference. Now, like I've already pointed out, swords are very rare, and because of the amount of materials and length of time needed to make one that is a one-handed sword, two-handed swords are even rarer again. That's not to say they don't exist. We do have references to them in the sagas, but they are like rarer than hen's teeth when it comes down to it. Now, regarding the double-haired battle axe's misconception, it's just not accurate. While double-haired battle axes did actually exist in the ancient world, they were not used in combat really at all, and they certainly weren't used in combat by the Vikings. See, if you look into Greek literature, a double-headed battle axe is called a labrys. They're very common in Cretan architecture and archaeology, and they're almost entirely used for ritual purposes. Now, double-headed axes do actually still exist in the modern day, but they're almost entirely used for axe throwing or lumberjack work. Like, you would use one side of the axe to chop down the tree and the other side to trim all the branches off it. They are not that common compared to regular axes today, and they certainly were not used in any sort of format by the Vikings, either in civilian life or in combat. See, if for combat, the Vikings favored three distinct types of axes. They had the throwing axe, the Dane axe, and the Skeg ox. The throwing axe, as the name implies, is designed to be used as a ranged weapon, but it can be used in melee combat in emergencies. As such, it's quite small, usually no more than a foot, I would say, in total length. It's very light, it's got a very small head, and it's designed with a distinct bend in the shaft, similar to that of a strong bow. Basically, this is what you get if you combine a tomahawk with a boomerang. They are designed to be thrown with one hand, they're very light, they're very fast, they can be used in melee combat and emergencies, but that's really not what they're designed for. The Dane axe is the other extreme. It's a massive two-handed weapon with a very large, very, very thin, single-headed blade. Basically, a Dane axe is what you get if you put a chef's cleaver on a pole about 5 foot long, roughly 150 centimeters, and then you gave it to a very angry Viking. In combat, the Dane axe is used by the berserker, more on them later, and was said to be able to split an unarmored man right down from the top of his head right down to his groin. If having a throwing axe is like having, say, a motorbike, Dane axe is like having a full-on ex-military armored vehicle, like a decommissioned Humvee that's still got all the armor and all the military stuff equipped just without all the weapons. It's large, it's powerful, and it sends a very clear, do not mess with me or you will regret it, kind of vibe. Now finally we come to my personal favorite of the Viking axes, the Skegox. Now if you are familiar with the show Vikings, you would already have seen Skegox in action. Ragnar Lothbrok, who I'll actually be talking a little bit about in this episode, his one-handed axe is a classic example of a Skegox. Skegoxes were wielded in one hand, usually with a shield in the other hand, apart from by the Ilfetnar, but more on them later, and they have a distinctive beard to the blade. This actually gives the Skegox its more common name, the bearded axe, and it also played a massively important role in combat. Now, you could use the Skegox's beard to hook your opponent's shield rim to create an opening, you could catch your opponent's weapon to disarm them, or you could even hook your opponent themselves on the wrist or around the neck, or if you were quick enough around the ankle, to throw them off balance. Now, Skegoxes, like the Danaxes, were far, far lighter than what most people would expect. Put it this way, the difference between an axe in the modern day that we would use for wood chopping and a Viking combat axe is all to do with weight and how it functions. A wood chopping axe in the modern day is pretty heavy. On average, they're about 2 to 5 kilos, and they rely not just on gravity, but also on the weight of the axe head to increase their force of gravity in the downward swing. They're designed to split logs. They are broad-headed most of the time, and they're designed to create a wedge that splits it apart. A Danax or a Skegox or even a throwing axe, like I said earlier, they're essentially a cleaver on a pole. They are designed to cut, not to split. They are extremely light and almost unbelievably thin. They are, well, do yourself a favor, go to a kitchen supply store, like, I don't know, somewhere that sells knives, look at a cleaver. That is how thin a Skegox blade actually is. They're insanely thin and very, very light and very, very dangerous in the right hands. Now, using the vehicle analogy, if Danaxes are like using a military vehicle, Skegoxes are the equivalent of having a good quality pickup truck, like a Land Rover Defender, a Toyota Land Cruiser, a Ford Ranger. It's capable of nearly a task, but it's still reasonably affordable, and it's also sending a very, very clear, do not mess with me vibe. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there are certain types of warriors in Norse culture, but of them, there's a true distinct types of shamanic warriors I'm going to be talking about now. You have the Berserkers, and you have the Ulfethnar. Now, you might be wondering, what in all the names of all the gods of all the pantheons is a shamanic warrior? Well, shamanic warriors were a very, very special type of warrior that were completely devoted to Odin. These are essentially the Norse equivalent of shock troops meet religious fanatics on the level of suicide bombers. They were said to take on the spirits of two different animals in combat, and, well, I'm going to explain to you how they were used. Now, bear in mind, there are three major differences between the two groups, the Berserker and the Ulfethnar. Number one, the Berserker and the Ulfethnar both take on the spirit of animals, like I said, but the Berserker chose the spirit of the bear, whereas the Ulfethnar, which is a plural term, uses the spirit of the wolf. Number two, the second difference, is the style in combat. Both Berserker and Ulfethnar will use shock troops and special forces, but their approach in combat mirrored their chosen animals. The Berserker used two-handed weapons like the Danax, and they were more concerned with strength and overwhelming power. They used crushing attacks to overwhelm their enemy. The Ulfethnar, on the other hand, they were dual-wielding specialists. They used a combination of two one-handed weapons, and they preferred a much more mobile style of combat, prioritizing speed and agility over pure strength. That's not to say they weren't strong, but they were much more concerned with being able to move around a lot more than just wailing on you with Danax. Number three difference is the physical size. Now, as I've mentioned before, the average Norse man in the Viking era was about 172 centimeters, which is 5'6". The average Ulfetinn, which is the singular term of Ulfetnar, was anywhere between 170 centimeters, 5'7", to about 182 centimeters, which is 6 foot in height. Usually, they're fairly lithe in build, akin to the rough build body-wise of a martial artist or a gymnast. Your average Berserker was anything over 178 centimeters, which is 5'10", and to put it simply, they were built like tanks. This is actually where a lot of the stereotypes of the Vikings being these mountains of muscle come from. The point is that both the Berserker and the Ulfetnar were both considerably larger than average, and they were specially trained in combat. It's, well, to quote the sagas here, It was said that they could not be harmed by fire or steel, that they ran into battle with only a fur pelt to protect them, that they would run barefoot over sharp rocks without noticing, that they would bite the rims of their shields in their battle frenzy, and that when they entered the Berserk Anger frenzy, they could not tell friend from foe. Put simply, you get them in the right direction, you get the Helheim out of their way. Now, if you're familiar with the show Vikings, Ragnar, Bjorn, and the other Ragnarsons, classic examples of Ulfit Nine combat. The dual-wielding specialists who move around and favor agility and speed. However, and while I love the show Vikings dearly, I'm not going to bash on Vikings today for a good reason, but if you've seen the film The Northmen, you have seen the best possible example of the Ulfit Nine in combat. Like, I saw that film when it came out in 2022, and if I'm being honest, it was close to a religious experience for me. I'm very open about the fact that I'm Norse Celtic pagan, but this film, for me, as an archaeologist, I got my degree in archaeology at uni. I have been studying the Vikings in some capacity since I was 9 years old. This film was the most accurate film I've ever seen in my life. Like, there's only one scene in this entire film that isn't 100% historically accurate, and you can easily excuse it for the storytelling aspect. Like, seriously, Robert Eggers, the director, he consulted with archaeologists and historians at every single stage of the film's production, and they have gone on record afterwards as saying that this film could be shown in museums for how accurate it is. Is that accurate? I'm sorry for raving about this, but honestly, I love this film. I've talked a lot about it on the podcast, and if you haven't seen, I can't recommend it highly enough. Seriously, Prince Amleth, played by Alexander Skarsgård, is perhaps the most accurate portrayal of an Ulfitin in any media I've ever seen. And quite frankly, if you haven't seen it and you're after a genuinely good Viking movie that is just really well made, do yourself a favor and watch it. However, I should point out it doesn't pull punches when it comes to the violence and the brutality of Viking era warfare. It is not a kind film in that sense. It does not sugarcoat things. In addition, many people say it feels weird. That's because it's actually based on the Icelandic sagas in storytelling description-wise. So, if you try reading maybe an English translation of the sagas or one of the Norse, maybe the prose Edda or the poetic Edda, if you can't get your head around that, you probably can't see the film The Northmen without thinking it's a bit weird. That being said, I would still recommend seeing it. It is an incredible film. Now, also from the show Vikings, is a fantastic example of a classic berserker, Rollo, Ragnar's brother. Rollo, in real life, was actually not related to Ragnar Lothbrok. That's one thing the Vikings got very badly wrong. I'll be talking about that a bit later. But Rollo in the show is bigger than the average Viking by a very wide margin. He uses a Dane axe in combat. In fact, we actually get to see Rollo go full berserker anger in the first episode of season 2. I won't spoil it for you, but let's just say it's both awesome and terrifying, especially considering who he's going up against. Now, you might be wondering, well, why is Dahi telling me all this? Well, the reason why is that because that the Great Heathen Army regularly employed both types of Shamanic warriors against the Saxons during their invasion of England. But first, we need some context. As I've already mentioned, if you're a fan of the show Vikings, you'll be very familiar with the name Ragnar Lothbrok. If you haven't heard that name before, if you haven't seen the show, Ragnar was perhaps one of the most famous and successful Vikings to ever live. His name literally translates as Ragnar Hairy Breeches, or Hairy Pants if you're in the US, but that's another story, and I'll tell you that one soon, I promise, but it is a story for another time. Ragnar's exact birth date is unknown, as is his place of birth. He's mentioned in Danish, Icelandic, and Saxon chronicles, but some sources say he was Norse, others say he was a Dane or a Swede. Wherever he originally came from, Ragnar is famous across the Viking era in all the Viking world. He had raided England and Francia without mercy for decades, and he had well earned his reputation as a very cunning and very successful war chief. However, you don't get that level of fame or success in that line of work without making some seriously powerful enemies. Ragnar's relentless raiding on settlements in the Saxon kingdom of Northumbria had led the king of Northumbria, Aelor, to declare a blood feud against Ragnar. Sometime in the first half of the 860s Common Era, Ragnar launched a raid against Northumbria, but was captured by the Saxons in 865 CE. In a truly sadistic choice of punishment, King Aelor had Ragnar thrown into a pit of venomous snakes. However, Aelor's victory was short-lived. You see, Ragnar's five or six sons all wanted revenge for their father's murder, and three of them went to the kings of Denmark, Sweden, and Norway and united them under one banner. Their mission? Invade England, kill King Ayla, and conquer the rest of the country. These three sons of Ragnar have gone down in history for their roles in the invasion, and they are Halfdan Ragnarsson, Ubar Ragnarsson, and the eldest of the Ragnar's children, and the leader of the Great Heathen Army, Ivar the Boneless. Now, why Ivar has that name, history does not know. According to some sources, Ivar may have been born with weak leg bones. Other sources say it may have been something like an allusion to something rather lacking in the bedroom department, for want of a better term. Still, other sources claim he may have gotten that name from his agility and speed in battle, but the truth is, we will never know for sure why he had that name. What all the sagas agree on are the facts that A, Ragnar was the eldest Ragnarsson, B, Ivar was ferocious in combat, C, he was a devout follower of the Aesir gods in the Norse pantheon, and D, he was a tactical genius in battle, specializing in using the terrain to his advantage and predicting all possible moves his opponent might make and countering them with contingency plans. As for the size of the Great Heathen Army, no one knows for sure. But, according to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, it was the largest invasion force from the Vikings that had ever landed in England. Now, some modern scholars have made the conservative claim that the army was only about 1,000 men, given that each long ship could only seat about 32 men per ship. But the truth is, we know it was a large force, but we don't know how large. Some contemporary Saxon chronicles say that it was as large as how many men, how many grains of wheat are in a field. But the truth is, no one really knows for sure. According to contemporary sources, the Great Heathen Army landed in East Anglia in 866 CE and began sweeping across England, pillaging and looting as they went. Late the next year, the army turned north and invaded Northumbria, eventually capturing King Ayla at Jorvik, which is now the city of York, in 867 CE. According to legend, Ayla was executed by Ivar and his brothers using the Blood Eagle, which is a ritual method of execution of debated historical accuracy, whereby the rib cage is opened from behind and the lungs are ripped out, forming a wing-like shape. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of exactly what happens, but let's just say it was only used for the very worst offenders. The Vikings did not use that technique lightly, and when they did use it, it was only used for the very, very worst of criminals. See, the reason they did that is that if you made a single sound when it was being done to you, your soul would be immediately damned to the realm of Helheim, which is basically the bad afterlife in Norse paganism. However, if you were able to endure the entire procedure without making a single noise, you got straight into Valhalla, no questions asked. So it was a very, very... it was rough. Like, there are reports of steeds and warriors being unable to watch this procedure. And so for King Ayla to be put to that, it was a sign that he had royally angered Ivar and his brothers. Now, the thing is that as for whether or not the Blood Eagle actually happened, no one really knows for sure. Some sources say that Ayla died in battle and that the Blood Eagle was actually ravens feeding on his corpse and picking apart the body. But in all honesty, no one really knows. The Saxons say that Ayla died in battle. The Norse accounts, especially the Icelandic account by Snorri Sturluson, says that Ayla was put to the Blood Eagle, but in truth, no one really knows for sure. No one's ever found the gravesite. No one's ever found remains that could be potentially applied to the Blood Eagle in any context. Like, we know what it is from the Norse sagas. We know it was described in pre-brutal detail, but we've never found actual archaeological evidence that ever happened. So that's why it says it's debated as to historical accuracy. Some people, including myself, believe that it actually did happen, but no one really knows for sure. Now, later in the year 867, the Great Heathen Army moved south, and they invaded the Kingdom of Mercia, capturing the town of Nottingham where they spent the winter. King Burgred of Mercia responded by allying with the West Saxon King Athelred of Wessex, and with a combined force, they laid siege to the town. The Saxons were unable to recapture the city, but a truce was agreed upon, whereby the Danes would withdraw to York. The Great Heathen Army remained in York for over a year, gathering its strength for further assaults. Ivar and Ubar are identified as the commander of the Danes. Now, I have to put in a point here. The Danes do not refer to people just from Denmark. Dane in Anglo-Saxon literature refers to Viking. It does not refer specifically to someone from Denmark. So if you're reading an Anglo-Saxon battle poem and it says the Danes landed at this location, it could literally mean anyone of Scandinavian descent. It does not necessarily refer to someone from Denmark. So Ivar Nuba, identified as the commander of the Viking army when they returned to East Anglia in 869 CE, and as the executioners of the East Anglian king Edmund the Martyr. And Edmund was killed because he refused their demand that he renounce Christ. Now, the precise account of Edmund's death is unknown. However, it's been suggested that by that his capture and execution is by the sons of Ragnar are likely to have occurred. Now, in 871, the great summer army around Scandinavia, led by a man called Baxey. Now, the reinforced Viking army returned its attention to Wessex, but the West Saxons, led by Ethelred's brother Alfred, defeated them on the 8th of January 871 at the Battle of Ashdown, slaying Baxey in the process. In 3 months later, Ethelred died and was succeeded by Alfred, who would become known as Alfred the Great. Now, Alfred the Great bought the Vikings off to gain some time. During 871 to 872, the Great Heathen Army wintered in London before returning to Northumbria. It seems that there had been a bit of a rebellion against the puppet ruler in Northumbria, so they returned to restore power. They then established the winter quarters for 872 to 873 at Torksey in the Kingdom of Lindsay, now part of Lincolnshire. The Mercians again paid them off to return for peace. And by the end of 873, the Vikings took up winter quarters at Repton in Derbyshire. In 874, following their winter stay in Repton, the Great Heathen Army drove the Mercian king into exile and finally conquered Mercia. The exiled Mercian king was replaced by a thing called Ceolwulf, who was picked by the Vikings. According to Alfred the Great's biographer, a man named Asser, the Vikings then split into two bands. Halfdan Ragnarsson led one band north into Northumbria, where he overwintered by the River Tyne, 874 to 875. In 875, Halfdan is known to have ravaged further north into Scotland, where he fought the Picts and the Britons of Strathclyde. Returning south to the border, in 876, he shared out Northumbrian land among himself, who, and I'm quoting directly here, ploughed the land and supported themselves, end quote. This land became part of what became known as the Danelaw. Now, bit of a side note here, because this is actually going to be important later. The Danelaw, after the Great Heathen Army, the Danelaw was everything north of a certain line that was considered Viking territory. Basically, if you get a map of the UK in the modern day, you get a ruler, you draw from the topmost border of Wales near Liverpool, that's the one. So you get draw a line from the top of Liverpool, draw it almost slightly diagonally across the top of East Anglia, everything north of that line to the border of Scotland, that was Viking territory. Everything south was Saxon. So that area north of that line was known as the Danelaw. Now, according to Asser, the second band of Vikings was led by Guthrum, Oshetel, and Andwind. This group also left Repton in 874, and they established a base at Cambridge for the winter of 874 to 875. In late 875, they moved on to Wareham, where they raided the surrounding area and occupied a fortified position. Asen reports that Alfred made a treaty with the Vikings to get them to leave Wessex. The Vikings left Wareham, but it was not long before they were raiding other parts of Wessex, and initially they were successful. Alfred fought back, however, and eventually won victory over them at the Battle of Edington in 878. This was followed closely by what is described by Asser as the Treaty of Wedmore, where Guthrum agreed to be baptized as a Christian and then for him and his army to leave Wessex. Then, sometime after, the Treaty of Alfred and Guthrum was agreed upon and set out the boundaries between Alfred and Guthrum's territories, as well as agreements on peaceful trade and the Werdegild value of their people. A Werdegild in Saxon and Viking culture is... basically, it translates to man payment, but a more accurate translation would be blood payment or blood debt. It basically is where, let's say you have a feud with your next door neighbor, and this feud has been going on for generations. Let's say your dad killed your neighbor's dad, neighbor's uncle killed your dad. It goes back and back and back. There's countless killing on all times. Now, if you want to settle that peacefully, you go to a local lord, and you say, okay, we need to settle this before both our families are wiped out, but neither one can afford to lose honor. So the Saxon lord will come along, He will do interviews and conduct investigations into how much each family has lost, how the feud first started, all that stuff. And then he will say, okay, how much has this family lost and how much has this family lost? And he will work out a price that each family has to pay the other so that they can both walk away with equal honor. Now, this would actually serve, and it was a very effective system in both Viking and Saxon culture, especially given the Norse habit of responding, shall we say, violently to insults. It was a pretty decent system for buying off potential violent retribution. So this is actually a pretty decent, you know, arrangement between Alfred and Guthrum. Now, in late 878, Guthrum's band withdrew to Chichester in the Kingdom of Mercia. Then late in 879, it removed to East Anglia, where Guthrum, who was also known by his baptismal name of Athelstan, reigned and killed as king until his death in 890. The parts of the army that did not go with Guthrum most likely went on to more settled lives in Northumbria and York. Some men settled in Mercia, and evidence of this is the presence of two Viking cemeteries in Derbyshire that are believed to have been connected with the Great Summer Army in Repton and a Heathwood. Now, in 878, a third Viking army was gathered by Fulham on the Thames. It seems they were partly discouraged by the defeat of Guthrum, but also Alfred's success against the Vikings coincided a new period of weakness in Francia. The Frankish Emperor, Charles the Bald, died in 877, and his son died shortly after, precipitating a period of political instability of which the Vikings were quick to take advantage. The assembled Viking army on the Thames departed in 879 to begin new campaigns in the continent of Francia. Now, in 892, the army that encamped on Fulham, now comprising 250 ships, had returned and re-established itself in Appledore in Kent. Another army of 80 ships soon afterwards encamped in Milton Regis, posing a threat to the Wessex Saxons. The army subsequently launched a series of attacks on Wessex. Due in part to the king's effort to resist invaders and defend Wessex, the Great Heathen Army had less of an impact against the Kingdom of Wessex than hoped, and saw little progress, eventually disbanding in 896. Throughout the 880s, the Viking presence in his kingdom encouraged Alfred the Great to protect Wessex. The king realized the importance of naval combat against the Vikings and sought the creation of a navy. In fact, Alfred ordered the construction of specialized ships that were supposedly twice as long as Viking ships, some of them possessing up to 60 oars, others possessing even more. Now, bear in mind, the Viking army is... The standard Viking longship was only able to seat about 32 people. That's 30 rowers, a helmsman, and a captain. So that's a pretty big difference in the level of ship design. Alfred also reorganized the army and set up a powerful system of fortified towns known as burhs. Alfred mainly used old Roman cities as burhs, as he was able to rebuild and reinforce the existing fortifications. Every freeman in the land could be called out to protect the realms in time of trouble, but the speed of Viking hit-and-run raiding, which was the primary mode of combat in the Viking era, had been too quick for the local militias to react. The part of Alfred's reforms was to create a standing army that could react rapidly to attacks. The Anglo-Saxon rural population lived within a 24-kilometer, 15-mile, radius of each burh, so that they were able to receive refuge when necessary. To maintain the burhs, as well as a standing army, Alfred set up a system of taxation and conscription that is recorded in a document now known as a burhal hidage. The burhs were connected by a series of network of military roads known as header paths, which allowed Alfred's troops to move swiftly to engage the enemy. As header was usually a reference against an invading army in Anglo-Saxon literature, it follows a header path is a road for use against a header. Some historians believe that each burh would have had a mounted force ready for actions against the Vikings. Based on the figures from the burhal hidage, it is probable that a fifth of the adult male population of Wessex, about 27,000 men, would have been mobilized at a given time. A common Viking tactic was to seize a center of importance, usually some sort of fortification, that they could reinforce and then use as a base to plunder the surrounding district. From 884, Alfred's reforms prevented them from doing this in Wessex. By 896, the Great Heathen Army was all but defeated and no longer saw any reason to continue their attacks, and they had dispersed into East Anglia and Northumbria. Those that were penniless soon found themselves ships and went south across the sea to the Seine in Francia. The influx of new settlers helped consolidate the ever-growing establishment of the Danelaw. Anglo-Saxon England had been quite literally torn apart by the invading Great Heathen Army, and the Vikings had control in northern and eastern England, whilst Alfred and his successor defended their kingdom and remained in control of Wessex. As for Ivar, no one really knows what happened to him. It's said that he went on to raid in Ireland and found the ruling dynasty in Dublin, but we don't know what happened to him after that. There's very, very few records of him after his time in the Great Heathen Army. So, yeah. Kind of anticlimactic, I know, but that's the way it happened. It was like Alfred was Ivar's equal, in terms of using the terrain to his advantage. That was why the Great Heathen Army had been defeated by Alfred, because Ivar wasn't in direct control. So, yeah, that's basically the story of the Great Heathen Army. Anyway, that's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening to The Raven's Grove. I'm Dahi, you've been awesome. I'll talk to you in the next episode. See ya.